You're listening to the Great Joy in Great Tribulation Internet Radio Network, and this is your host, Jim Searcy, reminding you that the King is coming. The Great Joy in Great Tribulation website is located at www.moresureword.com. That's all one word, all small letters, www.moresureword.com. That's www.moresureword.com. On that website, you'll find many things to help the saints scattered abroad build up their most holy faith and prepare to endure to the end of this 42-month Antichrist war on the saints. Once again, this is Jim Searcy reminding you that the King is coming. And our King said, when we see these things come to pass, that we are to look up and know that our redemption draweth nigh. Only be very strong and of good courage. Stay in the Word. Hallelujah. Hallelujah, Yeshua. Praise the Lord Jesus.
In the year 1676, a poor tinker named John Bunyan was imprisoned in Bedford Jail. While he was there, he started to write one of the most famous books in the English language. And everything is told as if it happened in a dream. "I dreamed," he says, "that I saw a man with a book in his hand, and a great burden on his back. As he read the book, he began to weep. Then, in a lamentable voice, he cried out, 'What shall I do to be saved?' For he lived in the city of destruction, which he learnt from his book was doomed to be burnt with fire from heaven, and everyone who lived there would perish in the flames. So Christian, for that was his name, went home to talk to his wife and children. 'Oh, my dear wife,' he said, 'and you, the children of my loins, I've tried to keep this from you as long as I could. But it says in this book, we shall all come to ruin unless we find a way of escape.' They thought some kind of madness had got into the poor man. And as it was drawing towards night, they hoped that sleep might settle his brains. And with all haste, they put him to bed. But the night was to him as troublesome as the day. So, when morning was come, and they asked him how he was, he told them, 'Worse! Worse!' His children were bewildered, his relatives incensed. They tried chiding him, and deriding him. Finally, they thought it best to take no notice. So, Christian went by himself into the fields, still reading his book and carrying his burden. No one would listen to his warning, and he didn't know where to turn. Then, in the distance, he saw a man approaching. His name was Evangelist, and he greeted him kindly. 'What are you weeping for?' he asked. 'Sir,' he answered, 'this book in my hand tells me to flee from the wrath to come. But also, I need to get rid of this burden which is on my back. I fear that it will sink me lower than the grave.' Then Evangelist pointed with his finger across the plain. 'Do you see yonder wicket gate?' he asked.
No, said Christian. Then, do you see a shining light? He said, I think I do. Then said Evangelist, keep that light in your eye and go in that direction. So you shall reach the gate. Then, when you knock, you'll be told what to do. Without delay, Christian began to run. His wife and children saw him running. They wondered, was he gone for good? And called after him to return. The neighbors also came out to see him run. And two of them resolved to bring him back by force. Soon, they overtook him. The name of the one was Obstinate. The name of the other was Pliable. And at first, Christian tried to persuade them to go along with him.
What? Said Obstinate. And leave our friends and our comforts behind us?
Yes, said Christian. For I am going to a kingdom where we shall live forever. Read of it, if you will, in my book.
Tush, said Obstinate. Away with your book. Hey, will you go back with us, or no?
No, not I, said Christian. Then said Pliable, if what Christian says is true, I intend to go with this good man.
For myself, said Obstinate, I will be no companion to such fantastical fellows. I'll go back to my own house.
So they parted. Obstinate went back, and Christian and Pliable went on over the plain.
Tell me more, said Pliable, about the place to which we're going.
There are crowns of glory to be given us, said Christian, and garments shining like the sun. And he who owns that place will wipe away all tears from our eyes.
Oh, come then, my good companion, let us hurry, said Pliable.
I can't go any faster, said Christian. I've got this heavy burden. As they were talking together, they had drawn near to a miry slough, which was called the Slough of Despond. It was a place where many travellers before them had been drowned. And, not looking where they were going, they both suddenly fell into the bog. Here they wallowed, grievously bedaubed with filth and scum. Nor did the weight of Christian's burden help him. Indeed, he was sinking fast. Pliable, being unburdened, managed in the end to scramble back. But he was very angry.
Is this the happiness you promised me?
He asked.
If we have such trouble at the start, what may we expect at the finish?
And he ran off home for a hot bath, leaving Christian to struggle on his own. He had quite given himself up for lost when he heard someone shouting to him from the further side.
Hello!
His name was Help. He told him there were stepping stones just below the surface of the mud, and he directed him to them.
You see, that's the hazard of this place, he said. It so spews out its filth that at the changes of the weather, these steps are hardly seen.
So Help gave him his hand and drew him out and set him upon firm ground again. And Christian continued on his way towards the wicket gate. Although he didn't know it, more trouble awaited him. For a certain Mr. Worldly Wiseman was the next to meet him. A very inquisitive and self-important gentleman, who dwelt in the town of Carnal Policy, hard by where Christian lived.
You don't mind my asking?
He said.
Have you a wife and children?
Why, yes, replied Christian. But I'm so laden with this burden that I can't take pleasure in them anymore.
Who counseled you to start on this journey?
A stranger called Evangelist.
Ah, I thought so. There's no one more dangerous. He's always misleading travelers. I'm older than you. Let me give you some advice, my good fellow. In yonder village, there dwells a gentleman whose name is Legality. A very judicious man, a man of very good name. He has skill to help men off with their burdens. He has, to my knowledge, cured several who were going out of their wits because of them. Moreover, there are houses standing empty in the village at reasonable rents. The food is cheap and good, and you can send for your wife and children and all live happily together.
Christian was, I fear, all too ready to listen to this Mr. Worldly Wiseman, who now proceeded most courteously to direct him away from his right road.
Do you see yonder hill?
Yes, very well.
By that hill, you must go. And the first house you come to is Mr. Legality's.
Christian shouldn't have listened to him. For what he had failed to tell him was that the hill ahead was a fearsome mountain. It towered above him, as if about to crush him. Worse than that, there were flashes of fire coming out of it. And Christian, because of his burden, might easily have fallen, and thus early on his journey have been burnt to death. Wherefore he did sweat and quake for fear. At that moment, who should appear but Evangelist, with a severe and dreadful countenance.
Aren't you the man I found weeping outside the City of Destruction?
Yes, dear sir, I am the man, said Christian, blushing for shame.
And didn't I direct you to the little wicket gate?
Yes, dear sir.
How then is it that you've so quickly turned aside?
When Christian had told his story, Evangelist said,
you have rejected the word of God for the advice of Mr. Worldly Wiseman. But Mr. Legality cannot free you of your burden. Mr. Legality is a cheat. As he spoke, there was a great clap of thunder.
And Christian called himself a thousand fools for listening to Mr. Worldly Wiseman. He turned back in haste and went like one who all the while was treading on forbidden ground. He couldn't wait to regain the road he had abandoned. But would he ever reach it? He wasn't at all sure. For narrow is the gate, it says in his book, and few are they who find it. At the very start of his journey, Christian had already been in the Slough of Despond and strayed most foolishly from the straight and narrow path. But he had been warned, just in time, by his friend, Evangelist, that his right road lay through a distant wicket gate.
As he was hurrying along, he came across three men, fast asleep, with fetters on their heels. They were called Simple, Presumption, and Sloth. Christian knew that to sleep on that particular road was like sleeping in the rigging of a ship when a storm was brewing.
"Wake up," he cried, "and I will help you off with your irons."
But they only opened one eye at him and yawned.
"I see no danger," said Simple.
"I want to go on sleeping," said Sloth.
"Every tub must stand on its own bottom," said Presumption.
Then they all three rolled over and went to sleep again. So Christian proceeded on his way, troubled to think that men in such danger should so little esteem his kindness in waking them. We are now to learn how wise it was of Christian to warn them. For as he drew nearer the gate, he saw that it was firmly closed. And even as he reached it, he felt the wind of an arrow swish past his ear and bury itself in the woodwork. Looking round in terror, he now saw on the opposite hill a strong castle with a host of dark, menacing figures on the battlements. Christian didn't dally. He knocked with all his might. A second arrow narrowly missed him.
"Who's there?"
asked a voice.
"A poor burdened traveller. I come from the City of Destruction, and I'm going to the Celestial City."
To his relief, the gate was quickly opened, and a hand pulled him in. Then Christian asked the guardian of the gate, whose name was Goodwill, "What mean these arrows?" To which he answered,
"Yonder castle belongs to Beelzebub, the prince of the devils. Both he and his soldiers will shoot their darts at anyone who tries to enter here. They aim to kill you before you reach safety. You are fortunate to be alive."
"Oh, I tremble and rejoice," said Christian.
"Why do you come alone?"
"Because none of my neighbours, and none whom I encountered on the road, saw the danger. But I'm not one to talk. I also nearly turned aside, persuaded by the arguments of Mr. Worldly Wiseman. And I don't know what would have become of me had not Evangelist met me again when I was musing in the midst of my dumps." "And, truth to tell, I'm still much inconvenienced by this burden. I just can't seem, however hard I try, to get it off my back. Could you please help me off with it?"
"No man can get it off for you," said Goodwill. "But keep to the straight and narrow path, and it will lead you to the place of deliverance."
"Oh, how long will that take?" Christian asked himself as he girded up his loins and plodded on his way. next stop was to be the house of the interpreter, who, Goodwill had told him, could give him useful lessons for his journey. It was a large and mysterious house, such as one visits in dreams. Its master, in answer to his knock, asked him what he wanted. "Sir," said Christian, "I'm here to seek your help."
"Come in," said the interpreter, "and I will show you a thing or two."
First, he led him into a parlour, which was full of dust, because it was never swept. So the interpreter called for a serving maid to sweep it. But the dust began to fly, and Christian began to choke. Never had he seen such dust, and he groped around blindly. Then he heard the interpreter telling the maid, "Bring hither water and sprinkle the room." And all at once, the dust had cleared, and the maid was sweeping it up with pleasure. "This parlour," said the interpreter, "is the soul of a man clogged with the dust of sin. But see how easily, by God's grace, it can be cleansed." Next, he led Christian into another dark room, where there sat a man in an iron cage. He sat motionless, with his eyes looking downwards, and his hands folded together. "Who's this?" asked Christian. "Talk with him and see," said the interpreter.
"I was once a flourishing professor," said the man, "both in my own eyes and also in the eyes of others. I was on my way, as I thought, to the celestial city, and I was confident of getting there, but I failed to keep watch. I followed the pleasures of the world, which proved to be an empty bubble. And now I'm shut up in this cage, a man of despair who can't get out."
No further explanations were given. No one said who put him there. But the interpreter whispered to Christian, "Bear well in mind what you have seen." Finally, Christian was led to a gateway, like the one which he had lately entered. Beside it sat a man at a table, with a book and an inkhorn before him, to take the name of anyone who wished to pass through. But the gate was guarded by fierce men in armour, ready to do to any traveller what hurt and mischief they could. And though there stood a great company of people desirous of going in, they didn't dare. Then, as it were a scene upon the stage, Christian saw a valiant man approach.
"Set down my name, sir," he said.
That done, he drew his sword, and rushing at the gate, he went to work, cutting and hacking with such deadly force that he cut his way to safety. "I think I know the lesson of this," said Christian triumphantly, as he resumed his journey. his safety would depend, it seemed, not on cleverness, but on simple courage. How his burden had got on his back in the first place, and why nobody else had burdens, as happens in dreams, we are not told. But never had he been so eager as he was now to be rid of it. And that, did he but know it, was half the battle. The road, from then on, was fenced on either side with a wall, and the wall was named Salvation. Along this road did burdened Christian run. Or, should we say, he did his best to run, so far as he could, with that load upon his back. At the foot of the hill, he passed an open tomb. Then, up again, upon a little knoll, he found himself beneath a wayside cross. And as its shadow fell across him, so suddenly the burden, slipping from off his shoulders, fell from off his back. It tumbled down the hill. It tumbled into the mouth of the tomb. It was never seen again. Christian kept feeling behind his back. He couldn't believe it. It was very surprising to him. And as he stood there, in amazement, behold, three shining ones appeared. The first one said, "Your soul is now swept clean of sin." The second stripped him of his mud-stained rags and gave him bright new clothes. The third one handed him a parchment. "Guard it carefully," he said, "and surrender it only when you have reached the gate of the celestial city." Great dangers lay ahead of him, but for the moment he was light as air. So Christian gave three leaps for joy and went on singing. At the foot of a wayside cross, the burden, which had been such an encumbrance to Christian, had finally fallen from his back. He now set off again, free as a bird and light of foot, along the narrow way. Suddenly, to the left of him, two strangers jumped over the wall and came at him apace. The name of the one was Formalist, and the name of the other, Hypocrisy. "Gentlemen," asked Christian, "where have you come from? And where are you going?"
"We were born in the land of vainglory, and are bound for the celestial city."
"Then why did you jump over the wall, instead of coming through the wicket gate?"
"It's too roundabout a way," they said. "Our countrymen always take this shortcut. They've been doing it for hundreds of years, so it can't be wrong."
Christian was dismayed. "But it's breaking the rules of the journey."
"What's it matter how we did it?" they said. "If we're in, we're in."
And they went on their way, laughing. At last, they came to a crossroads. One broad road turned to the left. Another broad road turned to the right, while the narrow road went straight on, up the great black back of the hill called Difficulty.
Which one would they choose? Formalist chose to go to the left, which led him into a dark wood. Did he but know it, the road was called Danger. And he lost his way forever. Hypocrisy chose to go to the right, which led him into rough ground, full of holes and hummocks. Did he but know it, the road was called Destruction. Here he stumbled and fell and rose no more. Christian paused and drank at a spring to refresh himself. Then he started briskly, straight on, up the hill. But soon he was wondering, had he chosen wisely? For he went from running to walking, from walking to clambering, and now he was on his hands and knees because of the steepness of the place. Then, just as he was about to give up, he espied a pleasant arbour, which had been made by the Lord of the Hill for the refreshment of weary travellers. Here, in the deep grass, Christian gratefully lay down. He pulled out the parchment, which the angel had given him, and read it for his comfort. Then, in the drowsy warmth of the afternoon sun, he fell asleep. When he awoke, it was late evening, so he quickly rose up and hastened on his way. Then, coming towards him, he heard the sound of running feet. And out of the twilight, two men appeared. The name of the one was Timorous, and of the other, Mistrust. "Sirs, what's the matter?" asked Christian. Timorous answered,
"Oh, the further we go, the more danger we meet." "Yes," said Mistrust, "for just ahead, there lie two lions. Whether awake or asleep, we know not. But if we come within reach of them, they could easily pull us to pieces."
So saying, Timorous and Mistrust ran on down the hill, leaving Christian much perplexed. For he now said to himself, "If I go forward, I shall perish. Likewise, if I go back to my own country, I shall perish. What am I to do?" Then he remembered his parchment, and felt for it under his coat. It had always been a help and comfort to him, but though he felt everywhere, he couldn't find it. He must have dropped it. And it should have been his passport, without which he couldn't enter the celestial city. As so often happens in dreams, that which he dreaded most had come to pass. He had no choice. He must go back. So, sighing deeply, chiding himself for being such a fool, he retraced his steps, looking on this side and on that. It was growing darker all the time, and the night was full of whispers and unearthly sounds. Dark though it was when he reached the arbour, God directed his eye to the place where the parchment lay. It must have slipped from him while he was asleep, and with great joy he picked it up. But then he cried, "Oh, dear, I have trod the same road 3 times, which I should have trod but once. How far might I have been by now upon my way?" He truly feared that he would be benighted. There were those lions, too. They seek their prey by night. "If they should meet me in the dark," he said, "how should I escape being torn into pieces?" And again he asked himself, "What shall I do?" There was still light enough to read his parchment, and this is what he read. "Desire now a better country, that is, the heavenly one." And with these words to strengthen him, Christian resumed his climb. And lifting up his eyes, he saw against the sky the towers of a stately palace. The Palace Beautiful. "Here, perhaps," he thought, "they'll give me a lodging for the night." But before he could approach, he heard close by in the darkness the roaring of the lions. The only way forward was along a narrow passage, which was about a furlong from the porter's lodge. This, he knew, was the place from which Mistrust and Timorous had fled. And Christian was never so near to running back after them. But the porter at the lodge, whose name was Watchful, perceiving now that Christian made a halt, cried out, "Fear not the lions! They're on long chains!" "If you keep strictly to the beam of light in the center of the path, they cannot reach you." So Christian moved on. He took good heed to the directions of the porter. At the same time, he trembled for fear of the lions. For now, they were on either side of him, straining at their chains. And how they roared and snapped at him, and how they tried to catch him by the foot. But Christian soldiered boldly on, and in another minute he was through and had reached the gate unharmed. Then, somewhat breathlessly, he asked the porter,
"Sir, may I lodge here for the night?"
"That depends on the nature of your business," he said, looking at him suspiciously. "For how does it happen that you come so late? The sun is set."
When Christian had explained as best he could, the porter said,
"Well, that's a sorry tale, to be sure. But I will summon one of the young ladies that lives here. If she likes your talk, she may let you in. Or, contrariwise, she may not."
So, Watchful, the porter, rang the bell. And there appeared, at the sound of it, a grave and beautiful damsel called Discretion. She questioned him closely, asking him what he had seen and met with in the way, and he told her, and she smiled, though tears stood in her eyes. Then, to his relief, she said, "We have to be careful here whom we admit. But this house was built by the Lord of the Hill for the benefit of pilgrims. So, with the Lord's blessing, come in."
upper chamber, whose window opened towards the sun rising. And the name of the chamber was Peace. So, for a little while, Christian was safe. And much he needed to renew his strength. For on the morrow, though he knew it not, he had to fight with Apollyon. On the previous day, Christian had climbed the hill difficulty. And, after braving the lions which guarded the gate, found refuge in the Palace Beautiful. He had spent the best night of his journey. And when morning was up, he was escorted to the roof by the four ladies of the house, whose names were Charity, Piety, Prudence, and Discretion. For they told him he should not depart till they had shown him the rarities of the place. "Look to the south," they said. And so he did, and saw in the distance the Delectable Mountains. "From the crest of these mountains," they told him, "you can see your first glimpse of the celestial city." Then the damsel called Charity said to Christian, "Have you a family? Are you a married man?" And he replied, "I have a wife and four small children." "Then why didn't you bring them along with you to share in your felicity?" At this, our traveller began to weep.
"I would willingly have done so. But my wife was afraid of losing the comforts of this world. And my children were given to the foolish delights of youth. So what with one thing and another, to my great grief, they would not come."
From all that had befallen him so far, you may think he did prudently to make the journey first alone. The other damsels said as much. And though now he was eager to depart, they counseled him most earnestly to arm himself before he left the palace. The armory was full of curious weapons from the past. They showed him Moses' rod and the jawbone of an ass, which Samson used against the Philistines, and the sling and stone which David used to slay Goliath. And then they fitted Christian out with the armor which their lord provided for the use of travelers, that they might stand their ground when things were at their worst. First, the helmet and the breastplate that could save his life. Then the faithful shield to fend off the fiery darts of the wicked. Then the trusty sword that could cut through anything. Finally, his feet were shod with shoes that would never wear out. For he was setting forth, they said, not against human foes, but against the wiles of the devil. Thus, fully armed, did Christian hurry to the gate. Before he left, he asked the porter, had he noticed other travellers upon the road?
"There was one," said the porter. "I asked him his name, and he told me it was Faithful." good, said Christian. I know him well. He's my townsman, my near neighbour. He comes from the place where I was born. I will try to overtake him. He was not to overtake his friend that day. Instead, he found himself in a solitary valley called the Valley of Humiliation. Here, after he had stopped to partake of the bread and wine and raisins which the damsels had given him, he was feeling well enough content. All of a sudden, a darkness fell across the sun, and looking up, he saw, stalking towards him, the towering shape of a foul fiend. A monster full 3 meters high. As happens in a dream, he recognized the fiend at once, and he knew his name. It was Apollyon. Terrified, he cast in his mind whether to go back or to stay firm. Then, considering that he'd no armor on his back, and to turn his back to his foe would give him the advantage, he resolved to stay firm. The fiend had now drawn very close. He had wings like a dragon. He had scales like a fish. And they are his prey. And out of his belly came fire and smoke. He looked upon Christian with a disdainful countenance.
Where have you come from?
He asked.
I've come from the City of Destruction, which is the place of all evil.
Then I perceive you are one of my subjects. For I am the prince of that city. Why then are you running away from your prince?
I was indeed born in your dominions, but I have given my allegiance to another, who is the king of princes. And to tell you the truth, I like his service better than yours.
I am the enemy of this king. I hate his person, his laws, and his people. Give him the slip and work for me and your wages shall be doubled.
But Christian knew that this was not the way to save his life.
The wages that you give are not such as a man can live on. They are the wages of death.
Then Apollyon broke into a grievous rage and shouted,
What you say is true! Therefore, prepare yourself to die!
Apollyon, beware what you're doing, Christian shouted back, for I am on the king's highway, the way of holiness.
But Apollyon straddled the way and barred his path.
I swear by my infernal den that you shall come no further. Here will I spill your soul.
And without more ado, he threw a flaming dart at him. Christian luckily caught it on his shield. Thereafter, though, the fiend's darts came thick and fast. And though he did all he could to avoid them, and in spite of his new armor, Christian was wounded in the head, the hand, the foot, and forced to yield ground. The combat lasted more than half a day. The woods re-echoed with the clash of arms. You couldn't imagine, unless you had been there, what yelling and roaring Apollyon made, and what sighs and groans burst from the pilgrim's heart. For you must know that, by reason of his wounds, Christian was growing weaker by the hour. Then Apollyon saw his chance and came in close. And, wrestling with Christian, gave him such a dreadful fall that his sword flew from his hand. And kneeling on him as he lay helplessly upon his back, he pressed him near to death, then raised his arm to make an end of this good man. But at that moment, Christian cried, "Rejoice not yet against me, O mine enemy. When I fall, I shall arise." And Christian nimbly stretched his hand out for his sword and caught it up, and ran Apollyon through. And with a hideous roar, as one that had received a mortal wound, the fiend drew back. Then, for the first time, Christian smiled. For, looking up, he saw Apollyon spread his dragon's wings and fly away, dripping blood over the fields as he went. But Christian, too, was bleeding copiously. And if he were to bleed to death, his victory would have been in vain. So, in his mercy, God directed him towards a certain tree, the tree of life, the leaves of which he now applied to all his wounds. And rapidly they staunched the flow of blood. Then, thanking God for his deliverance, Christian went forward to the valley's end. He left his heavy armor there, but kept his sword still drawn in his hand. "For all I know," he said, "some other enemy lies even now in wait for me." Indeed, far worse things lay ahead of him, worse even than his combat with the fiend. Next time, we shall tell how Christian, in the darkness and all alone, enters the dreaded valley of the shadow of death. And we shall find out why the valley has its evil name and reputation.